Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Crypto Rabbit Hole. Today, we're thrilled to have with us Tanya Reef, founder of Senda Digital Assets, a native crypto hedge fund based here in New York City. Tanya, thanks for being here and welcome to my program.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
Of course. So it's been a crazy week in the world of crypto, obviously, given all the volatility we've experienced. So I really appreciate you taking the time. Can you run us through some of your personal and professional background, and maybe discuss what led you to have an interest in finance and ultimately crypto and just the digital ecosystem?
Certainly. I think I'm actually going to frame my background around the circumstances that happened this last week in crypto because it's actually quite relevant. So what we saw just happen this week is really a peg blowup. What that means when we talk about peg is when, in this case, this was the a protocol, but we often see it in traditional finance with countries attempting to do that, which is to stabilize the value of a particular currency or coin or token to the value of the dollar. And when they do that, they try to take the volatility away and try to have people transact in this alternative currency as if it didn't have that much volatility relative to the dollar. But to do that, it's actually very, very hard unless the alternative currency is fully backed up with dollar reserves. That means what that really means is that you can actually exchange one-to-one the alternative currency and the dollar, back and forth. And if that's not possible to do, so far, countries that have attempted to do that through other means, or in this case, currencies, crypto assets that have tried to do that by other means have not been successful. It turns out that the country where I grew up, which is Venezuela, is a country that had many, many currency crises. And what I mean by currency crises is really big exchange rate blowups. And many of those were the consequence of actual pegs of the government trying to keep stable the value of the Venezuelan currency to the US dollar, that exchange rate stable. They tried to keep it unsustainably stable with macroeconomic policies that would not make that viable. And then what would happen is one day they couldn't sustain it and it would blow up. And that means the currency would depreciate by, 50%, 70%, 100%. And that was devastating for the layman in the country. In my case, my parents were professors at the local university, at the public university. Their wages in nominal terms did not change. But with these big currency depreciations, what that would mean is that all the imported goods would translate in a lot of inflation. And that means that the standard of living for my family would immediately drop big time, or what we call in economics real wages, which is really your wage not measured in terms of the nominal currency of your country, but in terms of the amount of goods that you can buy with that wage. That would completely sink because inflation was so high. And I lived through that many, many times growing up because we have many currency crises when I was growing up, when I was a kid, and when I was in high school. We had plenty of currency crises. I didn't understand at all what was happening. And that's why, in parentheses, I'm so happy you're doing this because I think it's very hard to get financial education and financial understanding when you're in high school because that's not something usually people learn, widespread teaching of finance. So hopefully this will help a lot of people in your generation.
Thank you.
But for me, I didn't know what was going on. I just saw my family really going through a very painful financial, strain. I saw people around me, my friends, my colleagues, just the population as a whole, really suffering quite a lot with these big currency meltdowns. And that's what got me interested in studying economics and, in particular, studying currency crisis. So I ended up coming to the US. I did a PhD in economics here in New York at Columbia University. And my dissertation was on currency crisis. When I graduated, I went to work at the International Monetary Fund, and that is an institution that was created to maintain and keep the stability of currencies around the world, really. I mean, there are other things in their mandate. One of their main mandates is to help prevent these big currency misalignments and these big currency blowups. So it was a very natural fit for me. When I ended up leaving the IMF to join Citigroup, where I spent a few years in the economic and market analysis team. And then from 2009 onwards, I spent all these years in macro hedge funds. And what that means is that I was trading currencies and interest rates, very often trying to guess whether there's going to be a currency blow up somewhere. And you would actually, if that was the case, you would bet that that was going to happen. Or on the other hand, if you felt that the currency was well managed in the particular sovereign country that had a well-managed currency, you would actually go long that currency. So I spent pretty much all my life around currencies and peg blowups and so on. And now that I switched to the crypto world, and I did that in 2021, I decided the crypto market, which was interesting to me from the start as a currency expert, I decided it was mature enough. It's still a nascent ecosystem. There's still a lot of things that we need to develop, grow, from regulatory things to infrastructure, operational issues, and a lot still ahead of us. But the market, I felt, was mature enough that I could enter professionally and offer a service for investors willing to enter the space in a well-managed directional exposure. I felt I could offer that. And so here I am. I did the transition in 2021. I literally just opened the fund for capital. We just launched the pilot launch in April, and now formal, we accepted external subscriptions in May. And here we have a spectacular peg blow up in the crypto world. So that's right down my alley. I was lucky enough to see that coming, and I was able to trade accordingly. But what is, I think, a very important lesson is that the lessons that we have learned in traditional finance, in how what we need for markets to work properly, in what makes a peg sustainable. Those lessons are not gone for the crypto world. The crypto world has a lot of great innovative technology. I'm sure you are aware of a lot of this. That's why you guys are interested. But it also, with all new technologies, of course, you have on the one hand the frauds and the Ponzi schemes and the malicious actors. But outside that, you have very well-meaning people, as you have very well-meaning governments, that try to maintain something that is financially and economically unsustainable because the way it is structured. And the problem we had last week had nothing to do with the code, had nothing to do with the technology. The technology was beautiful and the code was great, but they coded an unsustainable peg. At least at the time, it was unsustainable. And the reason it was because in order for this is, by the way, I haven't mentioned the name, but this was what we had blow up last week, is the Terra Luna ecosystem. Right, yeah. And what the way for that ecosystem to work at the end of the day, more general terms that would apply to any other crypto ecosystem that tries to do the same, is that they were offering a 20% interest rate for anybody that hold their stable currency, the UST, the Terra currency. And if you held that in a protocol that was called the Anchor protocol, you would get 20%. The question is, when you are confronted by a proposal like that, you want to ask yourself, where is the 20% coming from? Where are they getting the money to give you that 20%? And if that is coming from anything that is unsustainable, that is nothing that endogenous generating that high revenues in order to be able to maintain the peg, then you know that whatever is financing that 20% eventually is going to run out. And the question is just timing. It turns out whether exact catalyst of why this happened now, the timing of these things is always very hard. So the exact catalyst of why this actually happened now is, you know, it's I can't, you know, say for a fact. Some, you know, some people may say, well, it's because the financial markets were under strain, because the Fed is raising rates and so on. So it could be many things. I think it just, you know, it may not be a coincidence, let's put it that way, that 3 days before the peg was attacked, another protocol came out, Tron, that offered 30%. So why weren't the funds moved from a 20% to a 30%? And as soon as it did that, and some funds apparently moved, I don't know if it went there, but there were withdrawals from the anchor protocol that were big enough that caused some nervousness around the peg. The peg began to be attacked on Saturday. And I'm telling you, from then on, whether it was attacked on purpose or not, it doesn't matter. I heard a lot of people in the crypto world saying, well, it was a malicious attack. I worked in one of the hedge funds I worked was Soros, at Soros Fund Management. Soros is famous for betting against the peg in the British pound. That's how he made a lot of money when that peg broke. And clearly the market is going to, if they smell blood in an unsustainable peg, and they believe that if they attack, it's going to blow up, the market will attack it and the market will win every time. So you should not be exposed to these risks, you know, unless you're monitoring it so closely that you're able to get out on time. And you know, effectively what happened is the peg proved to be unsustainable. No, they could have injected more equity, but I don't think that would have solved it, because the equity would work as reserves, as, you know, sovereign reserves. And what would happen is that, you know, the market will actually take those reserves until there's none left, because there's nothing endogenously other than, you know, their founders or, you know, big investors injecting equity. There's nothing else behind it. So, or very little else behind it, to be more, you know, accurate, I guess. So eventually the peg becomes unsustainable, and, you know, it just blows up. What that means is all the money is drained. It lacks like a bank run, if you want. And then the value of both the Luna went to actually effectively zero. Mm-hmm. And we lost tons of money in the process. Let me just add that one of the things they did that exacerbated the contagion away from Terra and Luna to the rest of the crypto ecosystem was because they actually used Bitcoin. They bought Bitcoin as reserves to defend the peg. So when the peg began to be attacked over the weekend, what that meant is everybody knew that they were going to have to sell their Bitcoin to defend their peg, right? Because that's, you know, that's what they said they were going to do. That's why they bought it from. So the moment you knew that Terra and Luna were at risk, you also knew that Bitcoin was going to take a letdown. And you also know, because of the high correlation in the system, that if Bitcoin is going to take a letdown, everything else is going to take a letdown. So clearly, you know, you wanted to take the risk off the table. A lot of people probably did that. And you put all these things together and we have the result we had. Now, I will just end by saying, because I can talk about this forever, that clearly there are crypto tokens and crypto coins that are very risky. This was one of them. You want to do your due diligence when you invest in crypto. You want to vet very well what you're investing on so that you don't get caught up in things like our complete frauds, you know, remember like OneCoin or something like that, but also in things that may not be frauds, but they are unsustainable and they're risky. And so you want to stay out. Now, that doesn't mean that the rest of the crypto ecosystem is the same. You know, there are many coins and tokens that are fantastic, and you just want to distinguish the good from the bad and try to manage your risk accordingly and take advantage of opportunities when, you know, the prices are lower to bet these things appropriately and get in the good ones, the good quality ones.
So how exactly did you, especially transitioning from, you know, a traditional field, like, how do you value tokens and assess like risk, like just based on how new this whole thing is, since there's no precedent?
Absolutely. So the first thing you want to do when you are assessing risk is you want to understand very well the underlying protocol, the underlying governance of the actual token. And what that means is you want to understand that, first of all, whether it's a blockchain or maybe it's not a blockchain, is it centralized? Is it decentralized? You know, how many validators does the system have? There are a lot of things in the in every crypto coin or crypto token. Each one of them is completely different. So even if you guys, you know, sit down and, you know, you figure out how Bitcoin works and you really understand Bitcoin very well, it doesn't mean that then you can say, oh, you know, I'm going to, you know, invest in, you know, in Aave because that is the same as Bitcoin, but for DeFi. It's not the same. It's completely different. And they're all completely different. Bitcoin and Ethereum and Avalanche and Chainlink and all these things, they're all different. The different coins and tokens have different roles. Some are some you need to validate transactions or pay fees. Some you don't. Some are only governance tokens, et cetera, et cetera. So the first thing you want to do is understand what that token is actually doing. Do you actually need to purchase that token to participate in that blockchain? Because sometimes you don't. You know, if you have a DeFi token with a high, you know, total value locked in that system of borrowing and lending, it doesn't necessarily mean that you actually need to buy the token to participate in that system. So the fact that the total value locked is very high and a lot of people are using it may be good for many other things, but it may not be good for the appreciation potential of the token in particular that you're looking at. Similarly, you want to look, if you're looking at a smart contract token or coin, you want to see, you know, how much is the developer activity in the actual ecosystem. Is there adoption in the system? Are people actually using it to develop smart contracts, for example? So you want to understand how these things are designed, what their governance structure is, how what their supply is in how their how much supply of the token comes in the system and how often, like what's the inflation rate, is there a cap in the supply, is there not. You want to look at demand, how much developer activity it is, how many transactions, what's the transaction volume, what's the, etc. You want to assess the demand and the supply, and those things together will give you a sense of whether it makes sense, together with, you know, you want to vet these things to make sure you're not investing in some Ponzi scheme, in some like fake, you know, coin that doesn't, you know, that doesn't make any sense. So you understand the technology, understand the use of play, understand the fundamentals, which in crypto space, sometimes we call tokenomics, on-chain analytics, all these things that basically are telling you, you know, what's the demand, what's the supply. There are different, actually, you mentioned the word valuation. Valuation in particular is very hard to say this is the value that the token should have, right? But you can tell when things are looking funny with, for example, if you see a smart contract token that is having very little demand, very little developer activity, very little transaction volume, very little of anything, and suddenly the price is shooting up. So one thing people do is they want to actually look at, you know, the price divided by the developer activity or the transaction value or things like that, and try to see if that's actually widening, increasing or decreasing, to get a sense if in that particular token it's cheap or expensive. Now, like I said, because they're all very different, some of these, you want to think about them very differently. For example, Bitcoin is really not something you want to value with developer activity, because nobody is actually using Bitcoin as a smart contract platform. So Bitcoin is, you can think of it as store of value, and some people think of it as digital gold. So what's the way to value Bitcoin? Well, maybe you want to think, okay, let's assume Bitcoin takes 30% of the gold market, or 20%, or 10%. You think about, you know, what's the gold market? You know, you think, you assign that, you know, whatever it is you think makes sense, call it 30% to a Bitcoin market cap. You see how different that is from today, and you divide it by the number of Bitcoin that we know how much is they're going to be, because it's fixed. You take the net present value, you have a valuation, but that you can't apply for other tokens. So there is not one way to value these things. There is many ways. many ways. A lot of them actually have network effects. So the more people use them, the more value they have. So you also want to take that into account. And effectively use different models to guide your understanding of where things are. And importantly, just check that it's sustainable.
So basically,
we talk about stable coins, by the way. That's not the problem. Which, you know, but I would just add, there are many other stable coins in the crypto space that are sustainable and that are not algorithmic pegs. What the Terra Luna was an algorithmic peg, so it's different than, say, USDC, which is fully backed by fiat or fiat-like instruments. So they're very different things. Not all pegs are created equal in the crypto space.
So based on what you said already, you don't really seem to have a super dramatic or pessimistic outlook on crypto going forward, like a lot of people have. So I guess I have a double question.
Oh, no, not at all. I'm actually very optimistic on crypto going forward. Yeah. No, I mean, I do think you're going to have these corrections are going to happen, particularly when you have something that was so big and caught, you know, so much attention, like the Terra Luna ecosystem blow up. And that's, you know, probably will not be the last time we have one of these. But I think long term, there's a lot of potential for the good quality crypto. So yeah, I'm very optimistic.
So thinking less about your specific view and maybe just the general view on crypto, do you think this crash has maybe set back crypto a few years or months or whatever in terms of like general confidence or like institutional adoption? Or,
well, what I would say to that is I think we have three kinds of investors. There's one type of investor that is deeply skeptical of the crypto space. Some of them may like the technology, but they think the tokens make no sense, which I believe is a misunderstanding, because part of the blood of the public blockchains like Bitcoin is the token. Without the token, we don't have the ability to run a public blockchain. We can have run a private one, but not a public decentralized one. So I think there's some misunderstanding there. So I think there are, you know, in the best case, there's people that embrace the technology but are very skeptical of the coins or the tokens. In the worst case, there's people that are skeptical of anything digital crypto altogether. Those people are probably saying, see, this thing is hugely volatile. Look at these things. This is not a viable asset class. It's, you know, I told you so, this is going to blow up and so on. For these people, a few of them, I think, had been a little bit pushed into the digital world because of client demand. And, you know, it's a little bit of maybe FOMO or, you know, they're like, okay, you know, I think they thought this was going to blow up 10 years ago. It hasn't blown up. Let's see if, you know, if it's still around, people are using it. Let's learn what it is. But they remain very, very skeptical. And this is going to scare them away. And I think this is going to, have them feel a little bit justified in staying away and saying it's too early, we'd rather stay on the sidelines. So yes, I think for those people and those institutions, this is going to delay their adoption. I think there is two other type of investors. There's another group that have embraced the opportunities of the crypto ecosystem and the digital space. They very much see where the innovation and the opportunities can come in. They understand that it's early. They understand that in an early technology, there's a lot of volatility. And because of that, they may not be capable of actually getting involved in a directional sense in the space because the volatility is just too high for them or their institutions to stomach. So these people are still getting involved, but not in a directional sense. So what they do is they tend to get involved in arbitrage strategies. And arbitrage means you have one Apple, It has two different prices. You buy one and sell the other and keep the spread. So there's a lot of arbitrage strategies. They take different coins, particularly the liquid ones. They look at different exchanges. There's different prices. They arb, or you could see, you could think about different instruments that, you know, may have different prices. So there's a lot of these arbitrage strategies are going on, and that's a way to get involved in the crypto ecosystem without having directional exposure. So you basically, you know, are involved, but you are staying away from the big directional volatility. The other way they get involved is in venture tokens. So there's a lot of venture capital coming in the system. I doubt this is going to scare them. You know, venture players know that they're investing for the long run, and for, you know, opportunities that are going to materialize down the line. And the venture route has the advantage that you don't have huge volatility in the first 3 months you go in. You may have the investment could work well and you make many, many multiples, or it could just completely crash and you lose everything, but you'll figure out a few years down the line. So I think most of the investors are coming in through venture or arbitrage if they can't stomach the volatility. And then there's a third group of investors. These guys have done their due diligence. They see the opportunity. And in my view, when they see an important price correction, they are looking to maybe have a good entry point to come in and get involved at a much, much cheaper, much better levels now, and take advantage of the circumstance and be cautious, be responsible in betting these things, manage the risk appropriately, sizing, etc. There are ways to do this in a responsible way and take advantage of price corrections. And so I think we will see more of those come in as well.
So with all this hesitancy, like, what is it going to take, or how long is it going to take for crypto to really take off, like for people to really go all in and like fully put their trust in it?
It's very hard to tell. It's very, very hard to tell. I think it's a slow process. People need to see that crypto has staying power. They need to see that the good quality coins and tokens survive these corrections, these meltdowns, and they are still around and there's still interest and they're still being used. They need to see that it has good, positive, real world contributions, you know, like the borrowing and lending, like the tokenizations of various industries. They need to have firsthand experience there. The institutions need to keep up with all the innovation and make sure that we have a regulated playing field, that we can all feel comfortable that we can do our jobs in a safe, regulated way, that we can minimize the risk of malicious actors. So it's still going to take a while. And of course, we happen to be in a moment in time in which the macro ecosystem is going through stomaching, you know, rate hikes with the threat of inflation, the uncertainty of military conflict. So there is a lot of high risk events that will keep investors risk averse for the time being. But I think if the crypto ecosystem survives this period and can continue to thrive going forward, eventually I believe that the institutions will come in, and there's a lot of curiosity, a lot of people doing their due diligence, a lot of people recognizing the potential, and that's not going to stop. But it's super hard to time. It's super hard to time. It may take a long time. That's why I believe, I mean, it could be fast, it could be slow. It's very hard for me to say. I just think it's going to continue, and it's going to be something we're going to see. But it may take a very long time. I don't like to make price predictions. I think or adoption predictions. It's just very hard, very hard to know.
So how much is this Russian-Ukraine crisis, as you mentioned, going to factor into it? Especially with, you know, oligarchs trying to move their assets outside of traditional banking and cash. How is this going to affect crypto regulation moving forward?
I mean, I'm not an expert in regulations. I actually think that this will actually be positive for the digital asset space. On the one hand, you have incentives for both laymen in Russia and Ukraine to get access to crypto. It's just you know, because their local financial system is in under such stress, and crypto makes everything just so much easier. So there's something attractive there for them. On the other hand, as you know, as you mentioned, from a regulatory perspective, you know, the world is also interested in making sure that that we avoid anything that would allow easy access to malicious actors that
right.
would, you know, escape some of the sanctions. And I'm not an expert on this, but as you well know, on you know what the SEC is exactly thinking or doing on this whole Russia debacle and so on. But as you well know, the blockchains are very transparent. So we can track transactions in the blockchain. Everybody can see them. And,
course,
and
yeah.
that's not, you know, it's not your preferred way to launder money if everybody can track your transactions. Of course, the trick is whether you can attach the identity to the actual transactions. And I think regulators, from what I can tell, are getting better and better at doing that. I mean, we've seen that, you know, catching some bad guys in the last few years in some of these hacks and so on. But I'm not an expert at that. My sense is, at the very least, you know, regulators are going to be more incentivized to learn more about the ecosystem, teach themselves so that they can regulate it better. And that's only to the advantage of all of us, because the better the regulators understand this, the more, the better the actual design of regulation is going to be. It's going to help all of us that want to do, you know, good business and good things in the crypto space, and it's going to deter those that don't. So I really think this is actually going to be, in the long run, a very good thing if they get more and more involved.
That's very interesting. So I kind of want to go back to something you touched on a bit earlier.
Yeah.
You said you lost a lot of money on Luna in the past few weeks.
I didn't. The market did.
The market did. Sorry. So fine. So were you surprised by that, or did you just?
No, not at all. Because you know, like I said, I could spot an unsustainable peg in the Luna Terra ecosystem. So it was very hard for me to time when that peg was going to be attacked and when it was going to give in. But I thought the chances of that happening were very high.
Okay.
Similar peg laws, you know, happen in my country, Venezuela, you know, in Argentina, in a lot of, you know, developing countries over the years. And this was no different. The weak spot here was not on the code or on the technology. The weak spot was in basic finance, you know, currency dynamics 101 that we understand now. There are, I mean, to their defense, it could be that they're thinking, okay, we're going to sustain the peg in this, you know, in this way for a little bit of time until just buy ourselves time until we find sources of revenue elsewhere, and then the peg becomes sustainable. Maybe, but in the meantime, they were not sustainable and they just didn't make it on time. And I, in my experience, it's very hard to transition from one to the other. So they it clearly, when I looked at the system, I thought that was a risk. When I saw the peg getting under stress over the weekend, I immediately knew I needed to stay away. And when it didn't survive, I was not surprised at all. In my view, was fully expected, and I'm not the only one with that view. There are a few of us with experience in finance that could tell that was a big vulnerability. So we were not surprised.
Mm-hmm.
I think that also speaks for caution when anybody gets involved in the crypto space. They need to understand not only the technology, but also the finance and the economics behind it. You need both to be able to do a smart crypto investment. And if you don't know enough of both, then get expert advice or study it or ask or invest with someone that can do that for you, because otherwise you are taking a huge amount of risk. In this case, it was something that someone that had enough experience in the industry, I think with high likelihood would have spotted the vulnerability and would have tried to stay away. So I wasn't surprised, but I knew it was going to be very nasty. So I was able to take the chips off the table, wait it out, and have fresh powder for when things come back up. That's what I hope.
Are there any, so going forward, I guess, like, actually, I want to focus on Bitcoin for a second.
Yeah.
So Bitcoin was supposed to be a pledge against inflation. And for, a while, it's just been not anything but that. It's always been marketed as that, but really hasn't done so much to, you know, help people save their money because it's been so volatile. So if it's not an inflation hedge now, what exactly is it?
Yeah, it is actually, it's an excellent question, because people were anybody that was hoping Bitcoin to be an inflation hedge now is hoping for something that was just not possible so early in the game. So what happens is, for something to be an inflation hedge, you need to think of something like gold. And even when we think about Bitcoin as digital gold, if we are thinking of an asset that people are using as a safe haven, as something where they can protect themselves when things go sour. Okay. But because Bitcoin, in my view, is still so underowned relative to all the assets, you know, stocks, bonds, even gold, Bitcoin is way, way underowned. People are still too skeptical. Right. So when money flows into Bitcoin, it is flowing into higher risk. People know it's new, it's volatile, it's unregulated or not fully regulated. It's regulated in some ways, but not others. The custody, a lot of people don't even know how that works. They don't know how to trade it. Some people can't even touch it, like pension funds or a lot of the traditional institutions can't touch it because of the custody problem. So it's hugely on their own. So if a family office or an individual gets into Bitcoin, they don't say, oh, I'm going into Bitcoin because it's a safe haven. They say, I'm going to Bitcoin because I want to diversify risk. And in fact, I'm going into an asset class that is more volatile than anything else that I own, because I want to take more risk. And I think that that diversification makes sense. So you're going to increase the risk in your portfolio when you buy Bitcoin today. You don't go to buy Bitcoin to decrease the risk in your portfolio because you're scared and you look at a safe haven. That's because it's just very young and it's very new. So that means that Bitcoin is going to trade like a risk asset, because it is, because the volatility of Bitcoin is too volatile to be a safe haven today. So does Bitcoin have the characteristics in its code, in its algorithm, the way it's designed to actually work as a safe haven in the future? I do believe so. And I do think that Bitcoin eventually, we will see some decoupling from the more cyclical, if you will, crypto assets. But at this point in time, it's too early for that. Right now, Bitcoin is a risk asset and it's going to trade like a risk asset because it's too young, it's too underowned, and people are still using it to increase risk, not decrease risk. Now, I think the way it's designed, eventually we will get there. I still think within the crypto space, it is a very good candidate for a store of value when the volatility subsides. And by the way, the volatility, believe it or not, has been trending down over the years. So I believe that will continue with bouts like this one. I don't think this will be the last one, probably. We'll continue to see some of this happening, but the volatility is trending down. And as more and more people own it, then we may see Bitcoin trade with a different correlation and different characteristics. But I think that's a few years down the line. I think it's too early for that. So if you're sitting today asking yourself, I want to protect myself against inflation, you probably are not thinking, well, you know, Bitcoin is my first choice. If you are thinking, okay, at these prices, I think this is a good investment for, you know, the future, it has a good chance of appreciation, I think that makes more sense. But right now, I expect for the remaining of the year, Bitcoin to trade with risk assets. That said, I will say that it tends to be that when you have a market correction, when the market falls, what they say is correlations of all asset classes go to one. That's just a, you know, a saying, but really what really happens is people take risk off the table. And so all asset classes tend to fall and then all correlations tend to increase. So Bitcoin is no exception to that. And we will continue to see it trade as a risk asset. And when we have a big market correction, Bitcoin is likely to go down with the market as well and with higher beta.
So you clearly, and it's not just your view, it's actually like most people's view, that Bitcoin is definitely a long-term asset. It's not going to do anything for you right now. So are there any cryptocurrencies that you see that are more not short-term investments in the way that it's like get rich quick and it's just going to be up and down, but more like intermediate investments?
No, I wouldn't think of it that way. I mean, Bitcoin could very well be, you know, deliver a very high percent return in the short term, meaning, you know, in a few months, maybe it's a few years. It's you know, obviously it's hard to time the market. And the same is true with many other crypto assets. I think right now, after this big correction, I wouldn't be surprised if Bitcoin outperforms, because a lot of the bigger players and bigger institutions are thinking, okay, prices are cheap. The oldest crypto is Bitcoin, the longest blockchain, which makes it, you know, more secure in the proof of work world, is Bitcoin. You know, the supply, there are a bunch of issues why, you know, Bitcoin is now touted as, you know, the blue chip between crypto. So there are a bunch of reasons why people may say, okay, well, now that we have a price correction, maybe if I want to, you know, dip my toes in crypto, I'm going to start with Bitcoin instead of, you know, buying, you know, Mana or something, right? So maybe Bitcoin ends up outperforming right now because of that, and it's actually the best performing assets in the next few months. Who knows? But I see that that's a very possible, distinct possibility. But at any given point in time, there's going to be different cryptos that are likely to have the better short-term return. And instead of just focusing on those, we just want to try to understand what's the environment surrounding the particular months that you're trading in, to say, okay, in this environment, at this moment, these are the coins or tokens that are likely to do better. So I give you another example. When Facebook changed its name to Meta, right? I think before that, there were a lot of people that didn't even know what the metaverse was, but that was hard to miss because, you know, Facebook changed its name. That's right. A huge PR for the metaverse tokens. So, you know, maybe not surprisingly, all the metaverse tokens did fantastically well. It had a few months where they rallied, you know, many, many multiples and outdid every other crypto coin or token in the ecosystem. Does that mean that the metaverse tokens are going to do super well, you know, this year? Maybe not. You know, maybe there's some other catalyst or something else. When the Russia-Ukraine conflict began, the privacy coins did very well, you know, the Moneros and things like that. So my point is, there's going to be different points in time where there are different catalysts around the world that are going to make one coin or token, you know, or the other more attractive and more likely to attract flows for that point in time. Does that mean that they will actually survive, that they'll be around 10 years from now and they're going to be the winners of this? We don't know that. But it does mean that maybe you have a tradable rally that you can think makes sense for this particular few months or this particular year. There are a few tokens that are going to do well. And then maybe they succeed and maybe they fail. So when you are looking at, you know, short or medium term investments, you want to be aware of what's happening. If you just want to buy Bitcoin and sit on it and open it again in 15 years, well, that, you know, that's a different story. But in the short and medium term, there's a lot of catalysts in the world, some positive, some negative, and you want to pay attention of, you know, clearly the Meta, the Facebook changing its name was a positive catalyst. Clearly the Luna peg breaking was a negative one. So you want to see what's happening and try to adjust your positions accordingly. So the favorite tokens are always going to change. So the way I trade them, at least there's, I don't have like one, two or three names that I'm like, ah, these are the winners. I don't know which the winners are going to be, but I can track the tokenomics. I can track the fundamentals. I can track the adoption. I can track the catalysts, and I can make an informed bet in which ones I think may do better or worse at a particular given point in time.
So if not a favorite token, because obviously the factors change all the time.
Right.
Are there any you're keeping your eye on right now, at least specifically?
Well, I mean, I think, like I said, I think Bitcoin may do well because of what we just went through. Maybe people that want to dip their toes are thinking, let me just go through the safe bet. It's cheap now. So why actually put our chips in something that is less known and less liquid and, you know, more risky? So I think at this point in time, that may make sense. There are other options that may be interesting. So there's the Maker token, for example, that works with the DAI stablecoin. And if you believe that people may migrate away, you know, a lot of the people that were parked in UST that now don't want to be there or can't be there because it blew up, then maybe looking at alternatives. And if they want a decentralized stablecoin, maybe DAI is an option. And that means that maybe Maker will, you know, pick up a bit. It's certainly been trading better than others. So we need to keep an eye now. If we get a little bit of a broader pickup, it tends to be the case that a lot of the altcoins, a lot of the other smart contract platforms, for example, they tend to have a higher beta to risk than Bitcoin does. So they may rally stronger if we have a return of risk appetite. But of course, that's going to depend on a lot of things, not only in the crypto world, but also in our macro world, because we are in the middle of a Fed hiking cycle and removal of liquidity. So that, you know, it's not a clear picture. But if you are sitting there trying to decide what to do in the market and you believe that it's going to be a risk on period, then the altcoins are likely going to rally harder than Bitcoin is. If you're more in a risk averse period, then, you know, probably Bitcoin is going to outperform. And right now, I think it would be safe to say that we are in a risk averse period as of today. That may change tomorrow, but that's where we are today.
Okay. I can respect the safe answer, just giving every option, not taking a stance. But so I think we're running a little short on time. So I just wanted to ask one more very important question, I think. So basically, at its core, I created this platform to promote financial literacy, generally targeted to kids my age or even young adults who want to learn more about the value of money, as well as finance and crypto. So just overall, like, how do we get smarter as the next generation?
I think it's very important to educate yourselves as much as you can on finance and on risk taking. And there are a lot of resources out there. You know, of course, you can. You know, there's you know, the internet has plenty of of videos and interviews and articles. But you know, even the universities are offering courses that you can do online to teach yourselves about these things. And what I would encourage is, you know, everyone is, just because crypto sounds like, you know, sexy and there's a lot of, you know, money that people have made and so on, doesn't mean that, as we have seen this last week, there are a lot of risks inherent in this. So taking risk is, it's a very serious business. And you need to understand the pros and cons of doing so. And teaching yourself about risk taking, about how to manage risk, about how to size your positions, about how to not fall for, you know, get rich quick fast schemes, you know, Ponzi schemes, all these things. It's very important to learn about that. And, you know, like we discussed, it's not something they teach you in school, right? So, you know, reach out these universities. I'm sure there's plenty of top schools that are offering online courses, some of them for free, about, you know, taking risk. It doesn't have to be crypto. If you just want to, you know, it could be anything. It's about, you know, stocks, bonds, whatever. It's about just how to think about risk and volatility, and how to be safe while you are getting involved in anything that is risk-taking. We know that taking risk can deliver, you know, very exciting returns, but you can also lose a lot of money. And so you want to be safe and you want to teach yourself about that.
It's an amazing answer. Thank you so much. Great advice. So Tanya, I really enjoyed having you on here. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting.
Of course. So just like, how can anyone watching learn more about you?
I mean, if you want to reach out to me on LinkedIn or follow me, that's where I, you know, post some of, you know, some speeches, the stuff, the podcast. I have to be cautious on you know, a lot of the information I give out because of regulatory reasons. But I try to you know, to keep up to date at least the events and, you know, and whatever I can through there. So you can do that.
Thank you so much. I encourage everyone to look into that. As always, you can find me on Twitter at @AP_rabbithole or at cryptorabbithole.net. And as always, thank you so much for watching.
Thank you.